As-salam. In this one conversation with one of his companions, and apparently this was one of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam's close companions, because he has very long conversations and there are long dialogues between the companion and Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Now, one thing that we should kind of realize is these dialogues, of course, they're between two people, and so it is a conversation, but sometimes the imams, in certain situations and under certain conditions, they reveal a lot of information, you know. And so they were teachers, they were masters, they were this divine source of knowledge and wisdom. So talking about this idea of how some people, you know, superficially they seem to do everything that is against the commandments of Allah, but they don't, you know, we don't witness that they are facing some kind of calamity or destruction or you know, some kind of a hardship. So here, which is, you know, apart from the sociological and societal aspect of this issue, there's a theological aspect here, and that is that, you know, if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to punish individuals who disobey him, and he's going to reward individuals who obey him, well, in this situation, you know, we're saying that we see people are disobeying Allah, but we don't see any punishment. And so here, talking about this kind of a theological aspect, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he replies with a verse of the Holy Quran, and he says that, and those who deny our revelations, we draw them near to destruction step by step from where they know not. So this is this response where superficially it seems that these individuals who are disobeying Allah are not being punished, you know, but in the reality is that they will be punished in the hereafter. And that's really where, you know, it is serious and it matters, because if you get punished in this world, it's just for a day or two, but punishment of the hereafter, of course, lasts for an eternity. Two is that them not being punished is in itself a punishment, because when they don't feel that punishment upon them and they are disobeying the Almighty Allah, well, they continue to disobey Allah, and this circle of disobedience continues unabated, and eventually they end up in the worst of abodes in the hereafter. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
This Yusuf bin Yaqub came to our home in Baghdad, and he became the guest of my father. They were good friends on family level. And he says, my father asked him, what brings you to Baghdad? And he says, I have been summoned by Mutawakkil to go and see him. And so this person continues in the narration. He says he left Baghdad to go to Samarra, which was the capital at that time. And he says he came back 3 days later on, happy and safe. That was the main thing. And so my father asked him, you know, what happened? He said, I went to Samarra, went to a person where I was going to stay, and I asked him that, can you take me to the house of Ibn al-Raza? Ibn al-Raza is the title of the 9th and 10th and 11th Imam. Because Imam Raza alayhi salam was very famous during his days, his son, grandson, and great-grandson also were all known by the title of Ibn al-Raza. And the host said to him that, don't you know that the Mutawakkil has forbidden Ibn al-Raza to come out of his house? He was kind of in a house arrest, and nobody is allowed to go and see him. So this Christian, Yusuf bin Ya'qub, says, you know, I was thinking, what do I do? I would like to pay this money before I go and see Mutawakkil. He says, then an idea came to my mind. If your intentions are clear, Allah gives you the way. He says, I thought about it for a while, and then an idea came to me that I'll go out. Allah will take me to where I want to go. And he says, you know, the donkey went from one alley to another until he reached to a door and he stopped. And we tried to, you know, make him move forward, and he wouldn't move forward. So then he says, I asked my slave to go and ask around, whose house is this? And the response came, Hadhihi daru ibn al-Ridha. This is the house of Ibn al-Raza. So he said, if, you know, this is the most sufficient proof from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala about this. And then they knocked on the door. A servant came in, and as soon as the servant saw me, he says, he asked him, Anta Yusuf bin Ya'qub, without even, you know, him saying anything. And he says, to me, this was the second indication that I'm in the right place. That I didn't even give my name, and they already know about me. So he, you know, called me in to sit in the front area of the house. And then he says, the servant came in again and he says, you have 100 dinars with you? Give me that envelope. And he says, well, hadhihi thalitha, this is the third indication. I had not yet even talked to them about why I'm here. And then he came again, the servant, and he said, come inside, you have been called. And so he says, he went to the imam, I talked to him, he says, I told him, you know, I don't need to really discuss anything more. The signs that I have seen are sufficient. But Imam asked him, but are you not yet ready? And he hesitated. And then Imam, by himself, he said, I know you will die as a Christian. You will not become a Muslim. But you have a son by this name. He will become a Muslim. Not only a Muslim, he will become from the Shias of Ahlul Bayt, alayhimu salatu wassalam.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en/call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with the reporters.
After days of anticipation, Iran unleashed a barrage of missiles and drones against Israeli targets in the occupied territories. The legitimate response came after Israel attacked Iran's consulate in Damascus on April 1st, violating all international laws and conventions.
Iran's response comes within the international laws, specifically Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, which gives Iran the legitimate right to defend its national security. The Iranian attack on Israel has changed the geopolitical map in the region, and it was a strong warning to the evil regime.
The Iraqi people, as well as resistance leaders, hailed the Islamic Republic for the unprecedented response, dubbed Operation True Promise, which was within the inherent right of self-defense that entitles any country to protect its diplomatic institutions. Iran's retaliation came after the UN Security Council failed to condemn Israel's attack, which killed 7 members of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps.
The resistance and the people of Iraq surely stand by the Islamic Republic of Iran amid the failure of international community and the UN Security Council to condemn the Israeli attack on the Damascus consulate. Iran had all the rights to defend itself and respond with proper means and timing.
The significant operation clearly shows that Iran will not hesitate to take action against any threat to its citizens and institutions. Now, with its capabilities and military evolution, Iran has significantly changed the rules of battlefield in modern times.
Iran's retaliatory operation, which came after a long time of strategic patience in the face of Israeli's brutalities, shows that the Tel Aviv regime's days of hit and run are over. And Iran does not hesitate to exact a devastating revenge on its enemy, despite its all-out Western support. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Iran's retaliatory strikes on Israeli-occupied territories have drawn admiration and praise in Afghanistan from both the country's ruler, the Taliban, and the Afghan people. They said the reprisal strikes were completely legitimate, justifiable, and have expressed their support for Iran in the face of hostilities.
Long live and fingers crossed to the leader of Iran and to the brave nation and IRGC of Iran for their bravery in hitting the occupying Israel. They did this while many Muslims, like Saudi rulers, are indifferent to the cause and values of Muslim world. Praise Ansarullah of Yemen and Hezbollah and any nation who stands for the Islamic and human rights of Muslim people.
We are happy that Iran carried out the retaliatory strikes on Israel. Every Muslim should feel proud because the bully occupying Zionist regime came under fire. Look, Israeli forces have been oppressing our brothers and sisters in Palestine for decades. It's the time for all Muslim countries to unite and show the aggressors that we can and we have such capabilities.
The Taliban-run foreign ministry issued a statement on Sunday declaring Iran's recent attack on Israel as a legitimate defensive action. It added that Israeli genocide must be stopped in Gaza. Experts say the Afghan ruling authorities' support for Iran's reprisal actions and the Palestinian cause shows Muslims are now united against Israel, and hatred towards the Tel Aviv regime is now everywhere across the Muslim world.
Decades of Israeli occupation in Palestine and its atrocities have made all Muslims hate this regime and call for the regime to be crushed. Over the past few years, the attacks carried out by Hamas and Hezbollah shattered the Israeli regime's grandeur. Iran's strikes against Israel came amid Israel's devastating and deadly bombing campaign against Gaza.
The Afghan people also showed their anger with Israel for its war crimes in Gaza. They call for an immediate ceasefire in war-torn Gaza and demand that the international community help end the war and support Palestine in the face of Israeli invasion.
Afghanistan stands firm beside brotherly Iranian nation. Palestinian cause is bringing the two neighbors even closer. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Described as an act of self-defense, the Yemenis regard the extensive missile and drone strikes carried out by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps on the Israeli-occupied territories as a response to the Israeli regime's assault on Iran's consular building in the Syrian capital, Damascus.
We consider the Iranian strikes against the Israeli entity a legitimate attack and a response to the Israeli attacks that violated Iran's sovereignty by hitting its consulate in Syria. The Iranian attack is a legitimate move to punish Israel and is part of measures to stop the regime's ongoing crimes since October 7.
The public sentiment aligns with the official stance as locals overwhelmingly endorse the Iranian strikes, stating that the Israeli regime and its allies only understand the language of force.
The Iranian attack is supported not only by Yemenis, but also by all free people in the world. The Iranian response sent the message that Iran's capability is real and that all it was seeking was to liberate Palestine and stop the crimes by the Zionist enemy. Today we are facing an exceptional operation because Iran had not carried out an operation of this scale since the end of the Iran-Iraq war. Iran has been characterized by patience and deliberation due to the way it deals with hostile states. This is the first time that Iran has carried out a military operation against its enemies from within Iranian territory. This attack was successful, came at the right time to put the Zionist enemy in its place, and proved that Iran is capable of blowing up Israel.
Over the past few years, Yemeni-Iranian relations have strengthened, especially during the U.S.-backed war on Yemen, initiated by the 2014 revolution. This military campaign aimed to restore a U.S.-aligned former government in Yemen.
People here believe that the recent Iranian attack against the occupied territories significantly impacts Western powers, demonstrating unity among the resistance forces in the region. They view the attack as the beginning of the end for the Israeli regime and its supporters. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Pro-Palestinians in France gathered the day after what was reported to be the first peaceful night in Gaza in 6 months. The reason? The night before, Iran launched a historic missile retaliation against Israel, which prevented Tel Aviv from continuing their attempt at genocide and ethnic cleansing. At the demonstration, there was widespread approval, support, and even gratitude and admiration for Tehran's counterattack against the unprecedented bombing assassination at an embassy.
I'm not an anti-Semite, and as a Muslim, I want us all to live together peacefully, but I see Iran's attack as something good on their part. Iran is the only major country which has had the courage to attack Israel and defend Palestine's innocent civilians. This war can easily stop if Israel can finally realize that they are attempting a genocide.
Those who are occupiers do not have the right to legitimate defense, but Iran does have the right, and they used it to defend Gaza as well. Israel bombs and assassinates people constantly. How can people forget about what Israel has done?
Protesters contrasted Iran's actions with those of the French foreign minister last week. After mentioning the possibility of placing sanctions on Israel over Gaza, he immediately backtracked the next day in front of Parliament.
The French government is quite the accomplice in the genocide that Israel is waging right now. Why aren't there any sanctions despite all these deaths? And when France talks so much about defending human rights, it's simply shameful.
French forces claim to have contributed to Israel's defense. In a major blow to perpetual Israeli hopes of escalating the violence, Washington has already refused to join any potential Israeli attack on Iran. It's uncertain if the cycle of Israeli assassination and Iranian retaliation is now concluded, but Israel has already returned to indiscriminate bombing and mass murder in Gaza, despite 6 months of global outrage, the murder of 34,000 Palestinians, and 76,000 injuries.
Will Israel pursue an even wider war? Will more Arab nations be inspired to join the cause of defending Gaza? What's certain is that many are happy that, for one night at least, the guns aimed at Gaza's civilians finally fell silent. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Pakistanis are showing staunch solidarity with the Iranian retaliatory strikes against the Israeli occupied territories. Social media platforms overflow with messages of congratulations for Iran's effective response to Israel's atrocities, hailing Iran as a courageous champion of Muslim states willing to confront a Zionist regime, especially following months of atrocities against the Gaza Strip.
We are proud of Iran for taking a stand against Israel's aggression. The Palestinians have been suffering for decades, and it's time someone took action to protect them. Iran's attack shows that they won't tolerate the oppression any longer.
I fully support Iran's decision to strike back against Israel.
The Palestinians have been living under siege for decades, and it's high time someone stood up for them. Iran's actions give hope to oppressed people everywhere.
The Pakistani government has echoed both the sentiments of its citizens and voiced grave concerns over escalation of tensions in the Middle East. Islamabad underscored the Israeli blockade of Gaza as a significant factor contributing to the recent wave of tensions, emphasizing the urgent need for international intervention to prevent further escalations in the region.
Iran has done the right thing, legally and morally, because Iran has retaliated against Israeli unwarranted aggression and attack on Iranian diplomatic installation in Damascus. And that was a violation of UN Charter and international law. So what Iran has done is the right thing. They have responded in kind, and they have taken the battle to the aggressor, and they have hit Israel.
The people of Pakistan emphasize the urgent need for global intervention to halt the escalation of conflict in the region and call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Iran's attack on Israeli-occupied territories has garnered widespread support from Pakistanis, particularly due to their perceived alignment with the plight of people in Gaza. The warm reception of Tehran's operation by the Pakistani nation highlights its desire for a more assertive response to Israel's ongoing atrocities against Palestinians. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
German police have stormed the pro-Palestine conference in the capital Berlin and arrested a number of participants. The Palestine Congress was an important event for the Palestinian solidarity movement in Europe. It was set to be held in the German capital from April 12 to 14. The participants aimed to denounce Israeli apartheid and genocide and Germans' complicity in the genocide of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
We are the Palestine Congress. We accuse the Israeli state of carrying out genocide. And we accuse the German government of supporting, of abetting, of making possible this genocide.
On Friday afternoon, several hundred activists assembled in South Berlin to attend the conference. Soon after the conference started, it was interrupted by the city's police, which had dispatched more than 900 police officers to the area. Outside the conference venue, police officers arrested a man for hoisting a Palestinian flag on a building. The participants inside the conference venue also faced repression. Even the registered journalists were refused entry by the police officers who had been deployed inside the conference hall.
I was in the list, and as the moment as I came, they told me I'm not allowed to enter because there were too many people already inside.
The first part of the conference focused on the history of Palestine.
May marks 76 years since the Palestinian Nakba. 76 years of colonization, of forced exile. However, next month also marks 76 years of resilience, 76 years of a struggle for liberation.
The German police stormed the event during a speech by the Palestinian researcher Salman Abu Sitta, who addressed the conference via video link because he had been not allowed to enter Germany. Police said he was subject to a ban on political activity in the country.
The Palestine Congress was happening. We were watching a video. The police came and shut down the electricity. They didn't give a justification about it. They didn't tell us why. Nevertheless, the police came here, shut it down, said it in the loudspeaker. People are supposed to leave the building right now. You see, they're already taking people.
Chaotic scenes followed. At least two people were arrested inside the hall and several others were interrogated. German Interior Minister Nancy Faeser hailed the police, saying it was good how the police had reacted.
An hour after the start of the conference, German police stormed the conference hall because of a speech on the history of Palestine. In an act of extreme repression, they broke up the conference, declaring it an illegal assembly. However, the Palestine Solidarity Movement vows to continue the conference. Dieter Reinisch from Berlin.
Just one day after France's foreign minister earned praise for saying that sanctions on Israel could be coming over their refusal to allow humanitarian aid to Gaza, he quickly backtracked in a session before Parliament. Many are saying the episode revealed the uniquely powerful sway Zionism has in France.
France, although it has the biggest Jewish community in Europe, has also the most extreme right-wing anti-Palestinian Jewish community in Europe. And this community, this Jewish community in France, has a lot of saying and a lot of control over the media, over the political class. So you have very few people within this community who are protesting what's going on in the Middle East. Not like the United States and Great Britain.
The majority of France's Jews fled from former French colonies in Africa once those countries gained independence in the 1950s and 1960s, and they reportedly brought with them stringent anti-Arab and pro-imperialist views. In 2019, French Parliament controversially and incorrectly equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, and they are currently reviewing a proposal to fully criminalize anti-Zionism.
They're saying straight, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Therefore, any criticism of Zionism, any criticism of Israel, means you are a criminal because you're an anti-Semite. And so it's killing all debate. Now, all throughout the collective West, but especially in France, the number one threat to freedom of speech is the Zionist movement and the pro-Israeli movement. And I weigh my words because it's very, very dangerous to say something like that in France because you'll find yourself in court.
Since October 7th, support for Hamas and even support for Palestine is often being prosecuted as so-called apology for terrorism. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations were banned nationwide for weeks, leading to thousands of fines on protesters, with protesters arrested and prosecuted for apology for terrorism for as little as carrying a Palestinian flag. Without the ability to openly criticize the policies of Israel, many believe it's difficult to imagine that Paris will reduce its unconditional support for Tel Aviv, no matter how many atrocities and war crimes they commit against Palestinians. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
South Korea's progressives extended their majority in the National Assembly in an election largely seen as a repudiation of conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol and his People Power Party. Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung promised to work for the greater good.
The ruling and opposition parties must work together to solve livelihood problems. We will spearhead the efforts to overcome the livelihood crisis. I once again express deep gratitude to the South Korean people.
Many South Koreans feel President Yoon has been overstepping his powers with a series of missteps and controversial measures, including the failure to resolve an ongoing doctor's strike.
There were too many cases where this government pushed through policies that made no sense, as if it were a dictatorship.
While the vote revolved around Yoon and the economy, with problems such as a lack of affordable housing and increasing polarization, Yoon's foreign policy latitude will also be curtailed.
This is really bad news for President Yoon. He's going to have an extremely hard time getting anything through the National Assembly. And what's more, it may jeopardize some of his great relations that he's formed with the U.S. and Japan during his presidency.
A new progressive party launched by Cho Guk, a former justice minister, won 12 seats in the assembly, further tipping the scales against President Yoon and his People Power Party.
The two-thirds majority enjoyed by progressives in the assembly will enable them to fast-track legislation and push their liberal agenda. Meanwhile, President Yoon's pro-business reforms stand little chance of becoming law, with Yoon something of a lame duck for the final 3 years of his five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything.
باید فهمید.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
وانگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
کتاب الله.
Britain is facing food shortages and price rises because of various extreme weather events. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The United Kingdom faces food shortages and price rises as extreme weather linked to climate breakdown causes low yields on farms locally and abroad. Record rainfall has meant farmers in many parts of the United Kingdom have been unable to plant crops such as potatoes, wheat and vegetables during the key spring season. Crops that have been planted are of poor quality, with some rotting in the ground. The persistent wet weather has also meant a high mortality rate for lambs on Britain's hills, while some dairy cows have been unable to be turned out onto grass, meaning they will produce less milk. Agricultural groups have said the United Kingdom will be more reliant on imports, but similarly, wet conditions in European countries such as France and Germany, as well as drought in Morocco, have meant there is less food to import. Economists have warned this could cause food inflation to rise, meaning higher prices at supermarkets in Britain. Tom Bradshaw, the president of the National Farmers Union, said markets had collapsed as farmers failed to produce food in the punishing conditions. He added, "We're going to be importing a lot more product this year." One major retailer said the wholesale price of potatoes was up 60% year on year as much of the crop had rotted in the ground. Supplies of potatoes have also been affected by a 10% reduction in the area planted last year as farmers switched to less weather-dependent and more financially secure crops. Industry insiders said they expected a further 5% fall in planting this year. Jack Ward, chief executive of the British Growers Association, said there is a concern that we won't ever have the volumes of potatoes we had in the past in the future. He said wholesale prices were too low for farmers to generate enough income to cope with high prices of fuel, labour and machinery costs, as well as the effects of climate breakdown. We're not in a good position and it is 100% not sustainable. Supplies of carrots and parsnips, which are left in the ground and are also affected by southern soils, are also much lower than usual, pushing up prices. Martin Lines, the chief executive of Nature Friendly Farming Network, said, "The impact in the United Kingdom this year will significantly affect potatoes and the salad crop. Farmers are already facing delays in planting, with many fields in poor conditions. If planting occurs at all, it will likely be late, potentially leading to a shortage of root vegetables and potatoes this coming winter. Some farmers have ceased planning for planting altogether, opting instead to put fields into fallow or switch to alternative crops. This could also result in shortage of wheat, barley and pulses, as it's currently unprofitable to grow these due to the lateness of the season and low forecasted prices." Guy Singh Watson, the founder of the organic vegetables box company, Riverford, said he had so far planted virtually no vegetables. "Some overgrown plants cannot wait any longer to go in the ground and will have to be ditched. While retailers often turn to imports to fill gaps on the shelves, farmers across Europe are enduring a similarly difficult start to the year, with difficulties developing winter crops and sowing spring crops. France is experiencing the poorest start of its wheat growing season since 2020 amid cold and wet weather, while production of fruit and vegetables in Morocco is being affected by drought. Morocco's second largest reservoir has dried up, meaning irrigating crops will be difficult." Amber Sawyer, an analyst at Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit, said last year almost a third of the UK's tomatoes and more than two-thirds of its raspberries and Brussels sprouts came from Morocco. "And climate change worsens, the threat to our food supply chains, both at home and abroad, will grow," according to Amber Sawyer. Scientists have said this is just the beginning of the shocks to the food supply chain caused by climate breakdown, and that without rapid action to drive down emissions by ceasing to burn fossil fuels, the current system is unsustainable. Dr. Paul Behrens, an Associate Professor of Environmental Change at Leiden University in the Netherlands, said, "We should all be extremely concerned. We need to be doing everything to reduce carbon emissions while transforming our food systems." He added, "If we don't, I expect huge turmoil and escalating prices in the next 10 to 20 years. When food prices spiral, we always expect political instability. I wish people understood the urgent climate threat to our near-term food security. Fortunately, we know many ways we can make the food system more resilient while reducing food emissions. The biggest opportunity in high-income nations is a reduction in meat consumption and exploration of more plants in our diets." The British newspaper The Telegraph has also covered the same story and tells us more. "Food shortages are alarmingly likely in 2024 as climate change, transportation issues and global conflicts continue to affect supplies, according to a food security expert. New checks will also be introduced on goods coming into the United Kingdom from the European Union at the end of January under a border target operating model, further impacting food imports into Britain. Professor Chris Elliott of Queen's University in Belfast in Northern Ireland said the fruit and vegetables will be particularly affected. It follows shortages of eggs and oil throughout 2023, with supermarkets forced to ration tomatoes and cucumbers due to poor weather in southern Europe in February. Professor Chris Elliott, who chaired the government inquiry into the 2013 horse meat scandal, said, "My expectation is, as we've already seen in 2023 with some empty supermarket shelves for months, this will become more persistent as we go forward." It was about affordability but also availability and the likelihood of empty shelves, particularly fresh produce shelves in 2024, is very high. The food security expert said the potential shortages were caused by food insecurity in other countries, climate change and transportation issues. He also criticised the government for a lack of long-term planning and said the United Kingdom's agricultural industry has collapsed. Professor Chris Elliott pointed to Singapore, which has introduced plans to grow up to 30% of its own food by 2030, having relied almost exclusively on imports, as a good example for Britain to follow. He said, "We're virtually totally dependent on other countries for most of our fresh produce, our fruit and our vegetables. We are reasonably self-sufficient in dairy products. We were reasonably self-sufficient in poultry and in eggs. But that's also on the decline now as a result of the collapse of the food industry or sectors of the food industry in the United Kingdom." A 2021 food security report found that 46% of food consumed in Britain in 2020 was imported.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahruddin was.
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan.
Mawlavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Quran.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly life of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries and scholars. I am Atar, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Fadai and Shaykh Rouhani. Shaykh Fadai, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
All right, for today's discussion, we want to talk about another outstanding Shiite figure, another man who had struggled against oppression in Palestine and Lebanon. He is no one but Sheikh Raghib Haq. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the early life and biography of Sheikh Raghib Haq.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Raghib Harb was born in 1372, according to the solar calendar, Islamic calendar, I mean, in a village called Jibshit. And since they were in contact with many great scholars like Ayatollah Mehdi Shamsuddin, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Fadlullah, their family were actually always, we can say, in contact and communication with these great scholars. So it had its influence on the personality and characteristics or character of this great scholar, Sheikh Raghib Harb.
Yes.
He actually entered school when he was 7 years old. And of course, it is said that his mother knew the French language. Yes. And of course, his childhood was in that school, and mm-hmm. he learned the primary kind of studies in that high school. And later, actually, he got interested in Islamic studies and ulum al-dini. So that is why later in 1969, he went to Beirut and attend the classes of Hawza al-Ilmiya al-Mahdad al-Shari al-Islami, which was in the east part of Beirut. Allama Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Fadlullah was the founder of this Hawza al-Ilmiya. When he turned back from Hawza al-Ilmiya al-Najaf, Allama Fadlullah established this Hawza al-Ilmiya, this Mahad al-Shari. So that is why this Sheikh Raghib Harb was among the students of this Hawza al-Ilmiya, and he was also interested in issues related to Palestine and yes. And the Ummah al-Islami, Islamic nation.
Yes.
Sheikh Raghib Harb, in 1391, he went to Najaf al-Ashraf, and for advancing his studies in Hawza al-Ilmiya of Najaf al-Ashraf, he studied there for many years and became among the great scholars of Lebanon after studying in this, let's say, Hawza al-Ilmiya. Yes.
That's all right. Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice introduction. There was a movement called Harikat al-Mahrumin, or we can say the movement of the oppressed ones, Sheikh Fadai, which was established by Imam Musa Asad. Sheikh Raghib al-Harb, you know, also attended such a movement, and also the Amal movement. Let's be a little bit concerned about these movements and their role in Lebanon and Palestine. What was exactly the main goals behind establishment of such groups?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the year 1354 of Hijri Shamsi calendar, the movement of Mahrumin, Harakat al-Mahrumin, or oppressed people, was formed by Imam Musa Sadr, and Sheikh Raghib Harb was so active in that movement. They tried to help people, poor people, but that was the first step and the beginning stone for the next movement, which was Jumbish al-Amal, or yes. movement of Amal. You know, first of all, in the Harakat al-Mahrumin, they only wanted to help people, help poor people, in order to have their social life. But after that, in Jumbish al-Amal, or movement of Amal, we can say that they tried to spread, extend the border of their activities. Mm-hmm. You know, in Jumbish al-Amal, it was not just social, it was political, it was cultural, and mainly political, in order to fight
yes.
oppressors, not just help oppressed people. You know, that was the difference between Harakat al-Mahrumin and Jumbash al-Amal.
Very good.
First, they want to help oppressed, and then they started to fight oppressors. It's good to know that getting familiar with Imam Khomeini mm-hmm. in Najaf al-Ashraf was one of the main cause in his ideology, in order to fight oppressors. And we can say that Imam Khomeini was his ideological father, and Allama Fazlullah was his scientific father. And both of them, Allama Fazlullah and Ayatollah Imam Khomeini, affected Sheikh Raghib al-Harb, and this effect and impact, this became the next Hezbollah, the future movement, which was called Hezbollah. You know, after a while, Jumbish al-Amal had some problems in its members, mm-hmm. and some of them
didn't agree with the continuation of their activities, because some members in Jumbush al-Amal, they wanted to have some kind of reconciliation with Israel, but some of them disagreed yes. with that, and they okay. wanted to strengthen the mm-hmm. fight with Israel. So they exited the Jumbush al-Amal and founded Hezbollah. We can say that Sheikh Raghib Harb is one of the main founder of Hezbollah. Mm-hmm. Because Sheikh Raghib and Raghib Harb and Sayyid Abbas Mousavi, they got familiar with more familiar with each other in Najaf in yes. the lessons of Imam Khomeini, and both of them could affect Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, mm-hmm. which is now the present
the current Secretary General of Hezbollah. That's right. Okay, so all in all, this Hezbollah and the their resistance and muqawama, Sheikh Rouhani, against this zulm of the Zionist regime is not something new, isn't it? I mean, and it is rooted in both the political scene and also Islamic teachings. Some people might say that Hezbollah is only, or Jumbush al-Amal is only mainly concerned with the political scene, but it seems that it is something Islamic, pure Islamic, isn't it?
Yes, as you know, that Islam is a kind of political religion, because the Holy Prophet ﷺ himself established a kind of a political system in Medina. And after the Prophet ﷺ, his khulafa, the successors, of course, established the Islamic State. And Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ﷺ established the political and social, economic, political system. So that's why they were the founders of this Islamic state or Islamic, let's say, political system. Anyhow, Islam is a religion that cannot be separated from its political, let's say, foundations and fundamentals. That is why whenever we see that the religious kind of groups and parties like Hezbollah or the other political parties across the Islamic world, of course, they rooted in Islamic teachings, Islamic principles. We cannot say that politics is something, let's say, not attached to the Islam, or is something, let's say, extra or more marginal kind of yes. things in Islamic system. Yeah, it is Islamic, and Islam without the political system or without the state cannot be fulfilled.
Yes.
That is why, yes, of course, as you rightly mentioned, these kind of political movements in the Islamic world, all mm-hmm. of them rooted in Islam, not only yes. in Lebanon, but also in all the, across the Islamic, let's say, territory.
Okay, that's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And Sheikh Fadai, some people might say that we can't say such movements nowadays, I mean Hezbollah, Hezbollah or something like that, or Jumbush al-Amal, you know, the Western media label them as the terrorist groups and try to give a picture of them which is not at all accepted by the Islamic lands. How much do you think that the Western media has violated the true picture of such movements and their true goals behind them?
You know, if we consider the actions of our enemies during the history, we can understand that this is not a new phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get back to the beginning years of Islamic history. For example, when Amir al-Mu'mineen was martyred, some people in Sham, which was under the power of Muawiya, they said that why did they kill him? How did they kill him in mihrab, mm-hmm. in a mosque? Did Ali say prayer any time? So they believe that Amir al-Mu'mineen never said prayer, never performed any salah. You know, that is the job that all his enemies do. In Sham, Muawiyah tried to destroy the picture of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Why? Because if people became familiar with Amir al-Mu'mineen, they would never follow Muawiyah and accept Muawiyah. There would be an uprising against Muawiyah. The best way is to change and destroy the pictures of the leaders. That is why we can see nowadays that, and it is not just limited to Hezbollah. You can see that they label terrorism to Sepah in Iran, IRGC. They label terrorism to the governments of Bashar Assad in Syria, to Hezbollah. So, and if you consider their claim terrorism, so this question will be posed: who do they kill? Yes, Hezbollah kills some people, but which kind of people? Israeli oppressors? And what about American and Israel regime? Don't they kill anyone? And what kind of people they kill? They kill their people in their lands, in America. You know, at their statistics, just the American police kill more than 1,000 people, innocent people, American citizens in America. And they kill a lot of people in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, I don't know, a lot of terrorists in Iran, in Syria. Always they are busy with killing, but they do not call themselves a terrorist government. They call Hezbollah and IRGC and Syrian government as terrorists.
And sorry, usually, I mean, the actions of these movements, the Muqawama or resistance movements, are a defensive one rather than an aggressive one. I mean, it is not like, for example, killing innocent children in Palestine.
That is the idea of jihad in Islam. You know, in Islam, we don't have aggressive jihad. We only fight and kill enemy just after they fought
us. In defense.
For example, now we fight Israel not because they are Jews. We have a lot of Jewish people in Iran. Why don't we fight them? We just fight them because they are fighting us, because they are killing us. So that is defensive war. The only kind of war that we have in Islam.
Okay, that's all right. Thank you very much. It was February 16, 1984, that Sheikh Raghib Harb was getting back from, that's right, the mosque and masjid, we can say prayer, in Jibshit, in his mosque to the house, and he was unfortunately assassinated over there, and he was buried in his hometown Jibshit over there. His way is truly continued, and nowadays we could see the resistance of the people of Palestine against cruel powers, superpowers, especially Israel nowadays. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man. And thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Sheikh Raghib Harb. It was very kind of you. Dear listener, thank you very much too for listening to this episode of the program The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstudy.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.